Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week we'll learn about the SF Improv Fest from executive producer Jamie Wright. Composer DJ Mason Bates talks about his upcoming performances with the San Francisco Symphony. Bass Raymond Aceto talks about his role as the Reverend Blitch in Carlisle Floyd's Susanna at San Francisco Opera. Plus, critic Joshua Cosman offers his classical music picks for the month ahead. Stay with us. The San Francisco Improv Festival presents its 10th anniversary fest, 10 Years of Funny, which will feature 10 days of nonstop comedy created on the spot by top improv and sketch comedians at the Eureka Theater starting next Wednesday. I'm joined in studio by Bay Area native Jamie Wright, who is executive producer of the festival. Jamie's work has appeared on TV in Europe and the U.S. and has been featured in Time magazine. Among the fruits of his creative labor while with Boom Chicago was the 2004 viral video Florida Voting Machine. Check it out on YouTube if you have forgotten about that. It's quite a piece. In addition to writing and acting, he is also founder of Lecker Media, making short interview and documentary pieces, as well as comedy videos and PSAs. Jamie, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you very much.
Well, okay, 10 years, 10 days, 10 minutes or so. Go. What do we got
Just keep talking. Fill the air.
Well, there's something refreshing about improv, isn't there? I mean, compared to other comedy, is it just the amount of adrenaline that's involved in an improv situation? You feel it on both ends, I think, when you go to an improv show.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, if you look at it, let's say in comparison to sketch or stand-up, for that matter, like those are both things which are very much products of your mind. It certainly comes out of your experience and what you know about comedy and what you know what's topical or whatever it is that you're finding that's funny. And the difference between that and improv is that improv is actually involving all elements of what's happening at that moment. You know, it could be the way someone is standing funny, or the way they tripped over their words, or the fact that they're nervous. Any mistake that you make in terms like what's perceived as a mistake or stumbling over your words, it's like, et cetera, things like that are gifts. And that can be something that you then explore and drill down into. And it's very much, you know, one of the things about it is it's very much a happening and being there for it live. The audience is involved. All the actors are involved. It's something which is totally unique to that moment and is completely present.
And spontaneity, of course, involved in it.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's obvious, you know, I think anytime people get up and start doing bits that they've pre-planned, it just feels a bit tinny. You mm-hmm. know, it's like, oh, it's not quite.
It's like the old right. Bob Hope cue card or the Johnny Carson cue card thing. It's as funny as a joke may be. It's not as in the moment.
Yeah. It's a little bit canned. And so you get that feeling of just aliveness from it, which is a great thing about improv. And it's, you know, it's just a great way to see comedy, and it's a great way to, you know, in some ways, a lot of people take it as an approach to life. You improvise your life every day, really.
Don't we? Believe me. I think I'm experiencing that right now, actually.
Indeed.
So is this something you can learn or something you can teach? And are there basic improv skills that you would say improv 101? What are some basic tenets?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, the answer that you'll get from just about everyone full stop would be, you know, the basic rule is yes and. So you take whatever is offered and then you add to it. And then, you know, then it goes off into different schools of thought of like how you go from there, or some people just stop right there and like, that's good enough. Just continue going on with what comes naturally.
It's funny you should say that, because I took an improv course a while back, and yeah, it's the very basic concept of yes and, because you're feeding off what the other person is saying. And it still gets in my gut that an audition I did years ago, I was in this two-person situation, me and a woman, and the auditioner said, oh, just improv a few minutes of things. And I said, oh, honey, remember that time we went to Puerto Rico? And she said, no, you hate traveling.
It's like, oh!
And like, she said, no, you ruined it already. Because the show totally threw me. I just assumed the basics were known.
Yeah.
Yes, and? That was your cue. Well, come on.
Ultimately, you know, it ends up being a lot of different ways to teach and learn improv. And in San Francisco itself, in the course of the last 10 years, started, like, I'd say 10 years ago, there were probably two main places to learn improv. And one was Bay Area Theater Sports, which is now Bats Improv. And the other one was with the Flash Family, which is a long-running show. And group improv group that would do workshops as well as perform out. And so starting then, like, the Flash Family slowly kind of disintegrated or retired or, like, folded up camp. Some of them still teach, and some of them certainly still perform, but just in different areas. But it ended up being sort of Bats Improv for a while. And then other people started coming in and adding in terms of workshops and schools and places to learn, and to the point that we now have four fairly major schools to learn improv in San Francisco. So definitely in the last 10 years, improv has been a bit of a boom, and that is certainly owed to the work of those schools and the Flash Family and Bats Improv for training so many people who then were looking for a place to perform. And that's in some ways how the Improv Festival started, was as an answer to that need. Sean Landry and Sam Shaw and Bryce Byerly as well was involved in the starting of the Improv Festival. And the idea was to get a place for all these people who had learned improv and wanted to play, to give them an opportunity to play. And they went out and they found spaces and they set up a very lengthy festival. I call it a season. It was a 12-week event originally. And and it started a community that then it evolved into different schools. Leela, which is a major school now, and End Games and Unscripted Theater Company. A lot of the people who came out of Bats started that. And it's booming right now.
How did you get started in improv? Was there a particular comedian or a particular experience that got you hooked?
I always loved comedy. I was a huge fan of Monty Python and Robin Williams and growing up in the Bay Area, of course. And I just really enjoyed comedy, but I didn't really do any performance of it other than, you know, let's say in musicals. I was in acting in high school and in college and a little bit afterwards. But when I moved to Amsterdam in 99, I ended up working the bar at a comedy improv and sketch comedy show called Boom Chicago. And that was started by a bunch of Americans from Evanston. And they basically went to Amsterdam, loved Amsterdam. They had come there loving improv from seeing Second City and taking classes in college. And they're like, how can we make a Reese's peanut butter cup out of this? Like, we love our we love our peanut butter. We love our chocolate. Let's make it happen in Amsterdam. And so Boom Chicago was born. And is still going today, 21 years later.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So the whole Amsterdam experience, you were hooked on Amsterdam as well. And how long were you in that city?
Yeah, I was there for 7 years. And it started, like I said, I started learning multimedia. And I was working at the bar at Boom Chicago. And the idea was that that would pay for my schooling. And it did. But then I started doing jobs for the show. And then they wanted to add video to the show. And then I designed a system along with a technical director for the show. And then they needed a video director for the show. And then that was what I ended up doing. And I just kept renewing my contract every year because I just loved it. Mm-hmm. I loved improv. I loved the sketch that came out of the improv for the show. And it was just an amazing experience. And Amsterdam is an incredibly beautiful city, an incredibly livable city. I had a great time.
Nice. So let's talk a little bit about these 10 days that are coming starting next Wednesday. Some of the acts read like they were improvised on the spot as well. I'm thinking of Tall, Grand, Venti, and Huge, Piano Fights, Chardonnay, and White Women. So give us some highlights of what's coming up.
Those are all great acts, the ones that you mentioned. We have a number of folks that we're bringing into town. Boom Chicago, where I started, they are coming up to do another pair of shows this year. They performed for the first time at the SFIF last year, and people kind of flipped out over their show because they hadn't really seen, like, the short form and the sketch and the way they did it. It's pretty unique. And those guys all have great chemistry and have been with each other forever. And they all, you know, work in the industry down in LA, whether as writers on Key and Peele or SNL and that kind of thing.
So each of these acts, and there are many, are going to have their own particular format for their presentation. It's not strictly going to be an improv, okay, give me a topic kind of thing.
Yeah, it's not all, it's not, like there's short form and long form improv typically is how it usually gets divided up. Short form is very, you know, is epitomized by the idea of whose line is it anyway? Like, give me a word, now we're going to make a crazy game out of this word.
And speaking of which, you have Ron West from Whose Line Is It Anyway?
We do. He's been closing out our show for the last, this will be his fifth year, closing out the whole festival with Game Island, which is an elimination round with performers from throughout the festival. We also have Scott Adsit from 30 Rock with Jet Eveleth, who's an amazing improviser and teacher. And the two of them are doing Adsit and Eveleth on Friday and Saturday, the second weekend. We also have The Vendetta, which is Colton Dunn and Heather Campbell. Heather Campbell's also on the current version of Whose Line Is It Anyway on the CW. Colton is writing for Key and Peele and appears on the show from time to time. And it's just, it's a really fantastic lineup we have for the first weekend as well.
Nice. All of the information at sfimprovfestival.com. Speaking with Jamie Wright, the executive director of the festival, executive producer as well. It sounds like 10 days are going to be something different every day, that's for sure.
And absolutely.
A couple of shows a night for the most part.
Yeah. We start with two shows on Thursday. Then we have two shows on Friday, three on Saturday, and then continue on in that fashion going throughout the rest of the week.
Well, my Dutch producer, Niels Swinkels, tells me that Lekker Media has a special meaning. Could you talk to us about how you came up with Lekker Media?
That's right. I was when I'd come back from Amsterdam, I was looking for work in video production. I wanted to start a company. And I just happened, before I'd started my company, I happened to get a job and I had to give it a name. So for reasons of like, I was being hired by my brother, so I didn't want it to be like Wright Brothers Productions, because mm-hmm. I was just a little too nepotistic, I think, for his work. So I called it Lekker Media, and it just stuck. And I love the word. It's my favorite Dutch word. It means tasty or pleasing to the senses.
Uh-huh.
It's the first word typically you'll learn in Dutch, because they kind of call everything that they enjoy lekker.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And what are some recent projects, or what are you working on with them?
With Lekker? Probably we're going into another season of end-of-year videos. We do a lot of work for Adobe, and they have a sales conference where they have a kind of comedy video contest, and that's what we're gearing up to do. We do typically several, and I'll hire improvisers from around San Francisco to either come in and direct and coach, and then we actually coach their people to be funny, really, and be comfortable with a script, and to improvise and to play around and to develop communication for their company, which is very unique to their company. So if you watch one of these videos and you're not of that company, you might not really get all the jokes, mm-hmm. but apparently goes over incredibly well.
But part of your imprimatur is having humor involved in your projects.
Yeah, we like to, not only in terms of what we end up producing, we want it to be entertaining at the very least, but we also just want to have a really great time doing it, because that's part of the process and product as well.
Jamie Wright, founder of Lekker Media and executive producer of the San Francisco Improv Festival, getting underway next Wednesday at the Eureka Theater. 10 days, no reason not to start in.
Yeah, actually, the shows at the festival start on Thursday at the Eureka, and Wednesday is a kickoff party.
Very
nice.
The
10th that we're doing at the it's a VIP kickoff party at the Silver Cloud.
All right, all the information at is sfimprovfestival.com. Jamie, thanks for coming in today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Have a great festival. The San Francisco Symphony season opened last night with some special guests Bonnie Raitt and Yujia Wang. Concerts continue this weekend with the music of Stravinsky, Tchaikovsky, Prokofiev, as well as Ravel's Piano Concerto with Benjamin Grosvenor as soloist. The symphony then continues its Beethoven and Bates Festival, combining the music of Ludwig van Beethoven and composer DJ Mason Bates through September 13th. The upcoming concerts include Beethoven's Alternative Energy, plus Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 1, performed by Norwegian pianist Leif Ove Andsnes. Always a pleasure to welcome back to our studios composer Mason Bates to talk about the concerts. Mason has become quite an active advocate for bringing new music outside of the concert hall box to new spaces through, well, like the space that was recently opened down in Miami, the New World Symphony's new home designed by Gary. Plus his classical DJ project Mercury Soul, which has transformed spaces and brought new sounds to new audiences. He was here last year for additional Beethoven and Bates concerts with Liquid Interface, which was commissioned by the National Symphony, and the San Francisco Symphony commissioned the B-sides. He's back now with Alternative Energy, a work that had its first performances earlier this year with the Chicago Symphony and Riccardo Muti, where Mason is enjoying a multi-year residency. Mason, welcome back to KLW.
Always great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Really nice to have you here. Well, let's start, and then we'll move on to Alternative Energy. But this is a great residency you're having with Chicago. You're getting a lot of things done.
Well, it's a great orchestra, and, you know, the relationship you have with the conductor, in this case, one of the great living legends, is something that takes some time to grow. And, of course, you know, putting ideas to work in any institution, especially a big one like the Chicago Symphony, takes time too. So it's been nice that they've extended it a few times. And, you know, in addition to working with the orchestra, I've been actively working on curating projects there.
And now you're back with the San Francisco Symphony with conductor Michael Tilson Thomas, whose first description I wouldn't exactly consider offbeat mind freak, but there you have it in the press release that it's how you're describing the great maestro.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, Michael has this ability to speak to everybody in the room, from, you know, people who have never heard a note of an orchestra to people like me who spend their lives working within symphonies, and it's always interesting. He's also got this kind of Californian joyous adventurousness to him that, you know, always takes listeners on a kind of trippy journey. And this particular group of concerts, pairing the Beethoven Piano Concerto No. 1 with Alternative Energy, is a great example of his kind of provocative programming choices.
20 years and more going now, Michael Tilson Thomas and the Symphony. We're really lucky to have him.
Oh, man. It's a phenomenal partnership.
And just the energy he brings to the works and the podium is just amazing. Now, for this piece, Alternative Energy, you shopped around for some interesting sounds from car parts with Cynthia Ye of the Chicago Symphony Percussion Section. Now, tell me, are Ford brake drums have a different timbral quality than a Pontiac?
Well, what's interesting is that this piece does involve some found sounds, you know, instruments you go out and, like, dig up, literally. It's because it's an energy symphony. The idea of the symphony is that each movement kind of is a different stopping point in the story of energy. And the first movement is Henry Ford's farm in 1896, where he, you know, was tinkering around. And so in order to conjure that, I thought it'd be cool to have a very featured percussion section. And yeah, for the premiere, I went out with Cynthia Ye, and we dug around in, I think, a kind of like the Brisbane Auto Wrecking Yard or something, actually here to make this recording that we're going to be making next week. We wanted to find some equally sort of definitive pieces of junk. So I went out with Jacob Nisley, the principal percussionist here, and we had just a great time at the ABC scrapyard digging through all kinds of things. To answer your question, there is a difference in sound. I don't know necessarily between different models, but the older cars tend to sound better because they have less plastic in them. Mm. They have so much more ring when you hit them. So, well, that's what we're looking for.
I imagine you hit a bumper, a chrome bumper is going to sound different from a piece of plastic on a Chevy these days.
Yeah, it's funny. If you start looking at vehicles as something to hit with a mallet, it's amazing how quickly you start just turning away from some very nice-looking vehicles because you know they're just going to have a little thwack to them because of all the plastic.
So you're looking beyond brake drums as well. You're looking for all kinds of things that you're just tapping on to see what they sound like.
That's right. I mean, the score calls for a car part drum set, which means that we take like the tailgate of a pickup and put a kick drum pedal to it, and that becomes like kind of a car part kick drum. For a snare drum, we kind of have a muffler, that kind of thing. So, you know, there actually is a kind of history to using car parts in the orchestra. I mean, you can look at, you know, George Antheil or George Gershwin.
Sure.
You know, the car horns in American in Paris. So it's interesting to be using something that is original in that it's these pieces of junk had never been played before, but it's an you know, it's a concept that goes pretty far back in American music.
Does alternative energy use more extraneous percussion than your B-sides did, in which you used a broom, typewriter, and brake drum or oil drum?
Oil drum. It's probably about the same. I always find that the percussion section is a great way to smuggle in sounds and even kind of theater. You know, when somebody's playing a muffler or a pickup gate, you know, it has a kind of content to the sound that comes with a sort of meaning. And that's also what happens with the electronics. You know, the found sounds in the second movement of this piece, when we flash forward 100 years, are from the Fermilab particle accelerator in Chicago. And I went out and actually recorded those sounds there.
Well, before we hit that, what was your most surprising junk sound that you heard in the junkyard? I said, wow, who would have thought?
Well, you know, I think in this particular visit, the fact that the muffler we really wanted was still attached to a vehicle and still had this great resonance to it was a little surprising. I think generally you try to keep all sources of contact away from the thing that's resonating. And so when we started hitting this muffler and it had this beautiful ring to it, we weren't actually sure whether it was just the muffler resonating or everything else in the car. So in comes some, you know, totally ripped guy with like a hydraulic drill and, you know, just pulls off the car and we hit it and it's like, oh yeah, that's the muffler.
Nice. Anything unwieldy that sound, oh, too bad we can't bring this in, it's just too big or too hard to...
Well, there was definitely some kind of a door of a fire department truck that looked awesome. It said, you know, SFFD. But, you know, it didn't actually have any ring to it, so we left it for somebody else to, you know, forage.
A good joke for you later on that. Okay, but you mentioned the Fermilab. Now, why don't you first tell us the overall arc of alternative energy, because you described it as a kind of tone poem.
Well, I would say maybe a little more accurate description of it is an energy symphony. A tone poem I always think of as kind of maybe a one-movement project. This is a symphony in that it's multi-movement. In this case, it's four movements, some of which kind of track to the classical symphony of, you know, fast. You also, you know, we'll have a slow movement. You also have a scherzo that's kind of fun and upbeat, and a finale. But this collides that symphonic form with the kind of narrative forms of the 19th century of, you know, Berlioz, Liszt, and Wagner, where they would tell these, you know, kind of far-flung stories, you know, an opium-laced love story or whatever, and with music. And so this takes the four-movement form and starts, like I mentioned, on Henry Ford's farm in Chicago, zooms 100 years ahead in each movement. We then go to the present tense, Chicago, at the Fermilab particle accelerator. I thought it'd be really cool to have a massive industrial energy complex represented in the electronics dancing with the orchestra.
What sort of sounds did you discover there?
Well, we discovered all kinds of interesting things. I mean, what I was really looking for was the sound of a huge machine booting up. And after I'd been there all day recording, I didn't really have it. And I said, you know, I'm just going to let you all know, if you hear something that sounds like a giant switch of God being turned on, let me know. And then they started talking about the thing called the quench. They said, oh, that must be the quench. And apparently,
sounds like a great, it is a regular word. I was going to say, great Scrabble word, quench,
yeah, right.
But it is a word, quench.
Well, it's apparently when these hydraulic releases happen on top of buildings at kind of random times and in random places, and they're very loud. So they actually, all these engineers set up recording, you know, gear to like catch this sound. And they emailed me a few weeks later and said, hey, we got it. And it was like catching a genie in a bottle.
Neat. So, from the Fermi Lab of Chicago, what drug was used for your next journey's stop of your symphony fantastique known as alternative energy?
Well, it's funny. There was a book that became a movie called Cloud Atlas, and it's sort of like these nested narratives that go through time and place. And, you know, I'm not sure it was a direct inspiration, but it certainly you know, figured into kind of like a formal, you know, imagination here. The idea is that the piece goes from those two kind of past and present movements into a near future and a distant future. I thought it'd be interesting if we went to like kind of an energy sort of apocalypse in China, which would seem to be the next stop in our tour of energy. And then the movement after that is this sort of dystopian post-energy future where everybody's like on Iceland, the last remaining livable place on Earth. And you know, what does that all mean musically? The idea for me was to create, when I'm searching out these forms like Liquid Interface or Water Symphony or the B-sides, is to find forms that really push me musically into new territory. And so for this, I really wanted to have the sensation of like larger and larger forces of energy kind of exploding into each other. And so, you know, I was fascinated on a kind of musical textural level of having this like junk percussion setup explode into a kind of spinning particle accelerator in the second movement, or having at the very end of the piece all of the material from the junk percussion section return in a kind of woody, almost gamelan way on different percussion instruments.
So it is making a circle. It's all connected.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that at this point in symphonic music, you know, there are a lot of opportunities for kind of dramatic statements and dramatic, almost narrative statements that really sort of died out after the 19th century, particularly as music went into more kind of process-based things like minimalism or serialism. I really like to engage with the kind of storytelling qualities of music, and as long as you know the music is the sort of central focus, I think that has a lot to offer.
So does this dystopian end mean that you're not terribly optimistic about the far future?
Well, you know, I always try in pieces that have a kind of narrative to them, like Liquid Interface, which is a water symphony that Michael and the orchestra did in January, to not really preach so much as tell, you know, tell a story. And, you know, in Liquid Interface, the idea that each movement gets hotter until you're at this kind of evaporative music at the very end, and it began with glaciers. You know, you could certainly read a kind of global warming thing into it. But I'm definitely not so into, you know, political art. I mean, perhaps because, you know, I came from a pretty conservative part of the country and now live in a very liberal part of the country. I've sort of seen it all, and I think that, you know, music is something that can be very universal and doesn't have to sort of resort to, you know, political finger shaking, but it can certainly get up on a soapbox in a dramatic way.
Well, your near future is looking very bright indeed, as later this season, in next June, Ricardo Muti in the Chicago will be premiering a new work. What can you tell us about that? What are you working on there?
Well, the Anthology of Fantastic Zoology, that's this kind of almost ballet suite type of a piece. There's no ballet, it's just for orchestra. But I was inspired by those kind of multi-movement character driven ballet scores that you often hear, you know, excerpted from in the concert hall. It's a purely acoustic work that is kind of like a psychedelic Carnival of the Animals. It's a setting of this book by the magical realist author Borges, and you have all kinds of imaginary creatures. And, you know, again, that form was chosen to kind of push me into new territories harmonically and texturally. And so one example, there's a palindromic animal in this crazy book by Borges. And I've never written a piece that can go backwards and forwards and still sound convincing. So that's one example of how it kind of pushed me out of my comfort zone. That's June 15th, I believe, and I'm deep in the weeds with that right now.
Well, we'll look forward to it coming to the Bay Area. In the meantime, we will certainly be enjoying alternative energy under the baton of offbeat mind freak Michael Tilson Thomas and the San Francisco Symphony. You'll be ensconced in the symphony as well, wielding your electronics, I imagine.
Right. Yeah, I'll be set up in the percussion section. And, you know, it's a real joy for me to return to the symphony with this particular piece. It's my biggest work. And, you know, Michael and the symphony have been such an inspiration in terms of like their vision of a kind of like, you know, omnivorous appetite stylistically of what a a symphony concert can be.
Concerts are Wednesday, September 10th through the 13th. Program also includes work by Rossini and Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 1, Alternative Energy by Mason Bates, the featured piece. Mason, thanks so much for sharing that with us.
Yeah, great to be back here.
Let's hear a little bit of that music now. Here is a portion of Mason Bates' Alternative Energy. Excerpt from Mason Bates' Alternative Energy. Information about those concerts at sfsymphony.org. I'm David LaTulipe, and you're listening to Open Air on Local Public Radio, KALW. My next guest, Raymond Aceto, is starring alongside Patricia Rossett and Brandon Jovanovich in the San Francisco Opera's production of Carlisle Floyd's Susanna. And even though it is one of the most performed of all American operas, written in 1955, it's finally having its San Francisco premiere as part of the new opera season. Raymond Aceto makes his role debut as Reverend Olin Blitch, the traveling preacher who falsely accuses Susanna of wrongdoing. He's been in a number of stages, both here and internationally, at the Met, San Diego Opera, L.A. Opera companies, and has graced the stages of many of the world's greatest opera stages. Ray, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Open Air.
Thank you, David.
Ray, you are no stranger to playing some of opera's most villainous roles. Now, what is it about that characteristic of these villains that appeals to you as a singer?
I really enjoy the dimensions that you can find in some of these roles. You know, there's so many more layers and so many more emotions and so many more sort of dynamics that you can find. And that's what I truly look for in these characters. And, you know, you say villainous, and villainous is one way to describe them, but, you know, you try to play the villain with a smile on his face to get sort of the villain you love to hate.
Now, let's talk a little bit about this particular, almost a villainous role, mm-hmm. Reverend Blitch. Mm-hmm. Now, we mentioned that this is the most performed of American operas. For those of our radio audience that don't know the story, can you give us a little Cliff Notes version of what it's based on and how?
Absolutely. So we're setting it sort of 1930s Eastern Tennessee, so you have all the aspects of Appalachia at that time. You might say that it's sort of post-prohibition and all the sort of moral things that go along with that. Basically, it's small town Eastern Tennessee, you know, where religion is really the thing that binds this community together. And I play a traveling preacher who comes into town for a week baptizing, saving souls, having tent revivals. And basically, we have this sort of wonderful, free-spirited girl, country girl named Susanna, who basically just decides one day that she's just going to take a quick dip in the creek, and some elders spot her. And that's really where the conflict begins. She's very innocent in this, but because these people are so zealous with the religious fervor, and then they get me involved, and then the Reverend Olin Blitch has basically a human crisis, a moral crisis with this free-spirited young girl.
Hmm. So it's part of it is based on the biblical story of Susanna.
Correct. Exactly right. Mm-hmm. Exactly right. Yes.
Now, Joshua Cosman has a terrific interview in this Sunday's Pink Pages, what we call our Pink Pages, the date book section of our Sunday paper, with the 88-year-old composer, Carlisle mm-hmm. Floyd, still going strong, mm-hmm. still doing
Absolutely.
Some wonderful things. And one of the things that's mentioned is that Floyd is his own librettist.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you can sense that comparing him to other contemporary composers, mm-hmm. that someone that has a keener sense of the marriage of the words to his own music.
Right. I really like the way Carlisle has set the text. And as a matter of fact, you know, we do these sort of Southern accents. All of us do these sort of Southern accents in playing these roles. And a lot of times he will write in, for example, the word for, F-O-R. We say fur, F-E-R, you know, because it's more sort of colloquial, so, sort of more of the dialect. You know, you don't see composers writing dialect. You know, Verdi didn't write in the dialect of any Italian province. You know, it was very sort of middle. But you can't really do that with a piece that takes place in eastern Tennessee. So he set the score very well, and he puts in, let's call it, dialect when he wants it.
You're making your role debut as a Reverend Blitch. Were you familiar with Carlisle's work before this?
I had done one of his pieces a million years ago in a workshop when I was a young artist called Bilby's Doll, another one of his pretty popular operas. But this is the first time I've actually been involved with the production. The role is just... it's amazing. I love it. It's got everything. It's got high and low, and it's got dramatic. It's got beautiful song, soft sections and emotional sections. It's really a tour de force for the bass.
And tremendous cast mates as well, working alongside Patricia Rossett.
Yes, and Brandon, our tenor. I've worked with them both quite a bit, and I've always loved working with them. And Pat and I have such a great rapport. We did our first Tosca and Scarpia together about 4.5 years ago. And so this has really been a great experience for all of us.
It's Raymond Aceto. He's performing as the Reverend Blitch in Carlisle Floyd's Susanna through the 21st at the War Memorial Opera House, conducted by Karen Kamensik, starring Patricia Rossett, Raymond Aceto, and Brandon Jovanovich. Now, you've been all over the world at mm-hmm. various stages of opera houses. Do you, mm-hmm. have a favorite?
You know, I don't really have a favorite. There's so many places I like for so many different reasons. One of the highlights of my season so far is I just got back from Italy. I was singing in the Arena di Verona in Verona, Italy, which
That's
is
a huge outdoor.
Right.
Wow.
It's a first century gladiator stadium. Yeah, it seats 15,000. And, you know, so it's just truly wonderful to be part of that, because just you walk through the I don't even call it backstage, because everything is just as it was in Roman times, these big stone arches and tunnels that lead you to and from your entrances. And, you know, you put your hands on the walls there and you feel the history. And you know, we're just doing opera there, but people actually went to die there. So,
yeah, no lions involved in your
productions. No lions involved, just sopranos.
And a few catty tenors.
And a few catty tenors.
So, villainous or otherwise, what roles are you working on that you're looking forward to?
Oh, well, this has been such an undertaking, Blitch. And I just enjoyed the process of it. I'm singing Vodnek. I'm working on that from Ruzalka. That's in Czech. That's a new one coming up for me. And let's see, what do I have coming up in the next couple of years? A lot of roles that I have done before. And what's nice about that is that, you know, you don't have to go back and relearn, but if you're doing it right, you're finding new layers and new colors, new dimensions.
It's Raymond Aceto starring as the Reverend Blitch in the opera production, San Francisco opera production of Carlisle Floyd's Susanna. Well, I wish you a wonderful run. We're going to hear
some
music from a recent rehearsal next,
yep. mm-hmm.
and we'll have you back next time you're in town.
I'd love to. Thank you.
We'll hear Ray Aceto in his introductory aria from Carlisle Floyd's Susanna, this from last night's rehearsal.
I am the Reverend Olin Vincent, I'm Captain but we expected you tomorrow.
I was coming day early for thanking and praying and fasting.
We're glad to have you, brother, and you've come in the name of the Lord. This here's Brother Hayes, Brother Bleaton, and Brother Ott. We are the elders of this church.
You're welcome among us.
Amen. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Amen. And a part to me and a bit, my brother. And we pray that the lost shall be found.
Raymond Aceto, a brief excerpt, all we're allowed to play here on radio as the opera is getting underway this week at SF Opera. Raymond Aceto in the role of Reverend Blitch for Carlisle Floyd's Susanna. It segues nicely to my next guest, our monthly beginning of the month guest, Joshua Cosman. It's one of his classical picks for this month coming, isn't it, Joshua?
Yes, it is, David. Thanks for having me again, as usual. Susanna by Carlisle Floyd is the second night opera at the San Francisco Opera, opening Saturday night and running through September 21st. Looking forward to this for a number of reasons, one of which is that it will be the first time that Carlisle Floyd's music has been done. The company has done some of his pieces, but this is the first time it's done as part of the regular main season. They did a couple of performances of Susanna as part of Spring Opera, and I think Of Mice and Men was done also as part of Spring Opera. There was one other one that was done. This was many a long year ago. But, you know, he and David Gockley have a very long and close partnership and friendship going back many a long year. They co-founded the Houston Opera Studio when Gockley was running the opera company there. And that started the careers of a number of young, important singers. But this is the first time we'll have a chance to hear this music on the main stage. We've got, in addition to Raymond Aceto, we've got Patricia Rissett, as you said, in the title role, and Brandon Jovanovich, the tenor, as her brother Sam Polk. That combination of names will quicken the memories of some folks who heard them in Madame Butterfly in 2007, which was really one of the great memorable performances that the company has done over the past decade or so, I would say. Then they returned 2 years later to appear in Puccini's Il Tabarro together, with other cast. So that's an opera that's done a lot of times by smaller companies, but not very often by companies of the size of San Francisco Opera. Mm-hmm. So that'll be a welcome opportunity to hear that piece. But that second night, the first night...
Well, let me also point people to the wonderful article you just I mentioned earlier in the Pink Pages.
Thank you. You're very kind.
Nice article, Talking with Carlisle Floyd.
Talking with Carlisle Floyd is really one of life's great joys. I mean, he's courtly and intelligent and articulate and thoughtful and a delightful person to be around. I'm hopeful maybe we'll be able to hear some more of his music here over the years. He's got, you know, an extensive catalog of operas, many of which are not done sufficiently often. In that article, I forget if I did put it in the article, he mentioned that his opinion was that his best work is not Susanna, but a piece called Cold Sassy Tree, which I heard at the world premiere in Houston 10 or 15 years ago. And I would sort of second his opinion. I'd love to see that come here. It's a wonderful piece of musical storytelling.
Also at the opera, one of the major works of the repertoire, Bellini's Norma.
Yes, that's the opening night opera, and this is something I've been looking forward to for a long time, because some of us remember Sandra Radvanovsky, the soprano, when she made her company debut here in 2009, opening night performance of Il Trovatore. It was just a magnificent performance, and I heard... Afterwards, there was some piece of gossip floating around that the members of the chorus had gotten together and decided to submit a petition to the management of the company that said all Verdi roles from here on out should be sung by all soprano roles, rather, should be sung by Sandra Radvanovsky. And I thought, yes, I could get behind that. it was just that good. But that was 6 years ago, and she has not been back since. So, and in the meantime, you know, she's been tearing up stages all over the nation and all over the world, and really kind of becoming a star of the that commensurate with her gift. So hugely looking forward to that. And then it just...
And this is all about her. I mean...
This is... Well, yes and yes. It is mostly about her. It is mostly about her. But there's all, it's also about Adalgisa, her sidekick. And that just got interesting because last week, the company suddenly announced, oh, by the way, we've got Jamie Barton, mezzo-soprano, to sing Adalgisa. And people comment, wow, because Jamie Barton, who's a young up-and-coming singer, has won the Cardiff Singer of the World competition last year, and last year sang this role at the Met, which in a performance that garnered enormous sort of thunderstruck, awestruck praise from everyone who heard it. And everybody, I guess when I say everybody, I mean me. I at least said, well, great, I can't wait till she comes here, but I had no optimism that it would be quite so soon. So she's going to make her company debut tomorrow night as Adalgisa. Also in that cast is the tenor Marco Berti as Pollione, Nicola Luizzotti will conduct. And this is a new production that's going to go elsewhere after here by director Kevin Newberry, who says it's going to be rooted in the Stone Age, but with a contemporary slant.
Okay.
I personally am eager to see what that means.
Well, not exactly from the Stone Age, but from the Golden Age of opera. We have a recording that you brought in of the incomparable Callas singing. Get people in the mood for Norma. Let's hear it now. And we'll back more with Joshua Cosman. The distinctive voice of Maria Callas, recorded at La Scala with Casta Diva from the opera Norma by Bellini. We'll be hearing Sandra Radvanovsky in that title role for the opening night of the opera tomorrow evening. A pick of my guest, Joshua Cosman. He's here at the beginning of the month to offer his classical picks for the month ahead.
Yeah, so that's the opera taken care of. Also, the San Francisco Symphony has already gotten back into swing. We had the opening gala last night with Bonnie Raitt and Yuja Wang.
And a very unique version of Rhapsody in Blue,
well,
would you say?
Yes. It was the jazz band orchestration rather than the full symphonic orchestration that we usually hear. And this is a version that Michael has sort of championed over the years. Michael Tilson Thomas has championed over the years. Very lean, very gritty kind of sonority that we don't usually hear from the full orchestra. And he kind of played that up, I thought, in a very interesting way. Very jumpy, jittery kind of rendition. And also, you know, the chance to hear Bonnie Raitt. You know, a voice that has meant a lot to me over the decades and still going strong at as she said, at my age or at any age.
Well, we heard from Mason Bates earlier in the show that I had pre-recorded, and it's another pick of yours for the week ahead.
I don't want to duplicate Mason's efforts because he can certainly talk about the piece better than I can, but I do want to second his endorsement of it because I think this is the third of the three pieces that Michael and the Symphony are doing this year, and in my opinion, it's the best of the three. It's dramatic, it's theatrical, it's witty and imaginative and surprising and beautiful and all kinds of things that we would like music to be. I don't know if you mentioned this, that it was first the Chicago Symphony brought it here when the Symphony was doing its smorgasbord of American orchestras during their centennial year.
Oh, I didn't realize they brought it here.
Oh, yeah. When in 2012, when the Symphony was inviting all the other guest orchestras to come and help celebrate the centennial with them, Muti conducted the Chicago Symphony in that piece here in Davies, and it was, I thought, by far the best orchestral piece we heard all year, best new orchestral piece. So I'm thrilled to be hearing it again. And that's going to be, as you said, on the program with Beethoven and Leif Ove Andsnes conducting. And then the following week, we have something else coming interesting, which is Ice Field, the piece by Henry Brandt that was premiered in 2001 by Michael Titi and the orchestra with the 88-year-old composer as the organ soloist. And that went on to win the Pulitzer Prize for Music. Sort of out of left field. It was a wonderful and surprising and intriguing choice, very much not the usual kind of Pulitzer-winning piece, but very much in the vein of Henry Brandt, who tended to think in great big spatial terms and you know, kind of in technicolor sense around all the time. So that piece is being reprised this time with another technicolor sense around performer, which is the organist Cameron Carpenter.
I was going to say flamboyant, but I guess you termed it flamboyant the same way in a different way.
Flamboyant. I think has other connotations, but yes, he certainly is. He's splashy and theatrical, and a brilliant technician, and a really deep and interesting musician. And he's come here for a number of solo recitals. I believe I haven't checked this. I think this is the first time that he's actually playing with the orchestra. So that will be a rare and wonderful chance. That's September 18th through 22nd at Davies Symphony Hall. And both of those concerts are at the symphony website, which is sfsymphony.org. Having talked about Mason Bates, who's one of my very favorite living young orchestral composers, I want to segue to another one of my very favorite living young orchestral composers, which is Derek Bermel, who's not only a composer but a clarinetist. And he's going to be the featured composer this year with the New Century Chamber Orchestra. You know, every year for the last few years since Nadia Salerno-Sonnenberg came on as the artistic director of the orchestra, she has picked a composer to focus on over the course of a season to do a number of that composer's works, and then also to commission from them a world premiere. And Derek Bermel is really an interesting addition to this program. He's extraordinarily eclectic in his interests. He's got pieces that are based on his studies of Bulgarian folk music and pieces that are based on his studies of Gunai and drumming, and he writes jazz for big bands, and he writes rap, and he does all these kinds of things. And when you hear me say this, you think, oh, in other words, he's a dilettante, he's a dabbler, he doesn't know where his interests lie. And that's an understandable conclusion to draw, but in this case it's completely false. Each one of those things he does with extraordinary conviction and imagination and technical facility, but also eloquence. You can tell I'm a big booster of his music, and so I'm delighted that he's coming to spend the year, or not to spend the year, but to figure on the concert programs. So this first program this month, which is September 11th through 14th at various locations throughout the Bay Area, is going to include three of his pieces. One of them is a clarinet quintet with him as soloist. It's called A Short History of the Universe, as related by Nima Arkani Hamet. And you're probably wondering, as I did, who is Nima Arkani Hamet, unless you're up on your particle physics. Nima Arkani Hamet is apparently one of the great theoretical physicists of our day. And Mr. Bermel spent four years as artist in residence at Princeton at the Institute for Advanced Studies, which is, you know, where Einstein and all those people hung out. And he listened to a lot of lectures by Arkani Hamid on space and time and gravity and all the deep things that physicists think about. And he took some of these ideas and put them into a clarinet quintet. That's going to be on the program. Also a piece of his called Oct Up, and a duet with him and Nadia Salerno Sonnenberg on the violin called Silviudades. None of those I have with me, but I have here an excerpt from a piece called
Orchestral Slides,
which gives some idea of what his music sounds like.
Well, let's get it in everyone's ears. Excerpt of the music of Derek Bermel, a piece called Slides, one of the styles of writing that we have
exactly.
of Derek Bermel, so you can't really call it a typical of his writing style.
Only in that it's, creative. As you hear, jumpy and interesting and full of surprises. So he's going to be with the New Century Chamber Orchestra. We didn't give the website. That's ncco.org, ncco.org. And one last plug, I want to mention that this month is the occasion of the opening concerts at Schroeder Hall, which is the small 250-seat recital hall that just opened at the Green Music Center in at Sonoma State up in Rohnert Park. This, you know, that's the home of Weill Hall, which has been open for a couple years, the big orchestral concert hall, and they've been talking about this much smaller recital hall. The name, of course, Schroeder Hall, comes from the brilliant young pianist out of the Peanuts comic strip, because Jean Schultz, the widow of the cartoonist Charles Schultz, was one of the lead donors on this project. I went up there a couple weeks ago and saw it. I haven't heard much music there, but it's a lovely space, very intimate, very kind of chapel-like, and they're going to use that to program recitals and so forth. The Finnish pianist Juho Pojonen, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, my Finnish is rusty, will be playing a program of ballades in the hall, ballades by Grieg, Brahms, and Chopin. That is this Sunday at 3 p.m. It's next Sunday. It's the 10th at 3 p.m. And the website there is GMC, Green Music Center, .sonoma.edu.
Well,
and that taps me out for this month.
It does, Joshua. It looks like it's going to be a busy month ahead, the full season underway.
Exactly so.
Well, I guess we'll see you tomorrow at the opera as well.
I will be there, but you won't see me unless I see you first. you'll certainly see me next month.
All right. Thanks for coming in. Joshua Cosman, our first of the month guest, to let us know what's happening on the cultural calendar in the month coming. I'm David Latulippe. You've been listening to Open Air on KALW. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. Send me an email, david@kalw.org, if you've got a show segment suggestion. Thanks to Neil Swinkles for helping produce the show. Out with some music of Darius Mio on this, which would have been his 122nd birthday. This is KALW San Francisco.